C1P. Number 16B.
Then at this moment she makes a real good break and says, "Ah, but Christ's truth, the spirit of life, and the friend of mortal men can open wide those prison doors and set the captive free." Now you have the intervention of Christian Science coming in. And you see very well here the main tone that is illustrated here. Namely, we are still in that third block of what? Of life and spirit. So the spirit of life, she talks here. And we are at the point of truth, namely the healing Christ. So, but Christ's truth, the spirit of life, and as the friend of mortal men, can really open wide those prison doors, can really bring health to a situation. So it opens wide and sets the captive free, and says, delay the execution, and wants to have a revision of the whole case, because it says the prisoner, which is mortal man, is not guilty. It is as if, again, we hear the beginning of this whole chapter where Jesus said to Mary Magdalene, "You are not guilty. Thy sins are forgiven thee." We come right back to that whole attitude that we take when we work in Christian Science, that we start out, man is never guilty. Thy sins are forgiven thee. We can never really help a person if we do not start out with that point, that man is always the idea of God, always the idea of truth, always at the point of health and wholeness, and therefore he has never failed, he has never transgressed a divine law, he has always been living according to the idea of God, and can never really sin, and can never get sick, and can never die. That's the truth about man. So, here he comes in and says, the prisoner is not guilty. We free men at once from every argument of error. The law of Christ supersedes our laws. And I think our is, in italics, in order to say, look here, everything that has been said in the court of error are not God's law. They are laws of people. People have made those laws. They have really established those laws, those health laws. And therefore, the law of Christ supersedes our laws. Let us follow Christ. Let us follow the true idea, the divine idea, the right idea. That is now the call, and so the whole thing is now brought to the court of spirit, or the court of truth, one way or the other you can call it. And in here we have again that situation that now we have a chief justice, but now it is no more really the materia medica, now it is the judge justice of the Supreme Court. Now she asks for justice, namely, we know that truth is always just and is the true judge. The plaintiff still is personal sins, the defendant mortal man, but now mortal man has an attorney, and that attorney is Christian Science. Whereas before in the court of error, you had an attorney of personal sins, namely false belief. So now instead of false belief arguing for the case, we have now Christian Science showing forth the true facts about men. And instead of appealing to a jury that is made up of mortal minds and autonomy, physiology, hypnotism, mesmerism, and so on, she says, Let's have a jury of spiritual sense. Let that judge the case. So here we have a complete different set in the court of spirit. So Christian Science, really as the attorney for mortal men, now speaks for the case and defends now mortal men like this. And here again we have seven steps. And these seven steps are now really overthrowing the false witnesses that we had before. So again she goes first to mind and says, instead of relying on the witness of the laws of health, she says man, or Christian Science says, man is only under the jurisdiction of mind, divine mind. He's never under the jurisdiction of health laws. Now we put man under the laws of mind, so that the patient has been sentenced unjustly, and his trial he had, Christian Science says, is morally illegal. Can you hear the illegality? Whereas we now have the legality and the law of mind. The alleged crime has never been committed, so that man is never really a criminal. So we start out that man has never committed a crime. He never deviated from being an idea of mind. And this is the starting point we certainly always have to take, that we always see our patient as an idea at the point of absolute perfection, never as somebody that we accuse. There is no accusation on men, on the true idea men. And that's why I feel Christian Science practice is something so beautiful. I think, I always think treating somebody is one of the most beautiful time one can have, one has in one's life, because there one is really forced to concentrate on the truth and really say, how beautiful. Man is never a criminal. He can never be accused of anything. And you begin to establish really the holiness of the idea man, the purity and holiness and wholeness and perfection and beauty of what God knows about men. And we do that in a treatment where we really are inwardly praying in unity with the reality of being. We are really lifting men really out of accusing him of anything. You know, instead of saying, well, it serves you well, you know, you have been doing this and you have been doing that and you were a fool in this and you have been fooling around this way and that way, it deserves your right that you get it back. Instead of accusing him, we really, in treatment, we really enter holy ground. We really put off our shoes and say, we leave any dirt outside. We don't enter the holy of holies with anything else but the purest sense of what man is when seen from the point of view of mind, as the idea of mind. That's why I think one has a very beautiful sense of love for those who we treat in a treatment. Because we really have to give to that man the best that God knows. And that demands that we have a great sense of love for his true identity, not for his wrong idiosyncrasies, but for his true nature, for what he truly is, for that how God knows him, for that what mind knows him. And that's, as we have seen, the only thing that is worthwhile knowing about man. Everything else that we know about man is not worthwhile knowing, really. That's why I feel a student really should always have a practice going along, because there really he is forced to not drop his standard of life and to enter into the closet and be alone with God and with the true idea man and hallow that idea man and glorify that idea man and see that he has never fallen away from mind. So here we can never really see man as a criminal, as somebody who has done something wrong, who has trespassed on some kind of error, not even that man has sinned. We even free him from the sense that he could ever have sinned. So we come to the second point of spirit, where Christian Science defends the case at the point of spirit and says that man is actually only amenable to spirit only. As if she would say, man has nothing to do with matter, only to spirit. We are only living in the realm of spirit and are conscious and in the rhythm of spirit and stay there. So that she says, spirit is man's only lawgiver. So the accent is on only spirit. She asks here, who or what has sinned? Has body sinned or has mortal mind sinned? And so Christian Science pronounces and says, mortal mind alone is capable to sin and suffering. You see, man is never capable of sin and suffering. So the body has committed no offense. The body on whom really disease has been found is really sinless. The body is really sinless. The body hasn't done anything. The body hasn't any intelligence to do anything anyway. He has no creative ability, he has no intelligence, he has no power, he has no activity, he has no creative faculties, so he can't do anything anyway. So the body has committed no offense. Mortal man, in obedience to higher law, helped his fellow men. The mortal, the patient, has tried to obey a higher law than the law of health, a higher law, and helped his fellow men. And this act should result in good. You have always spirit, should result in good to himself as well as to others. She shows here the logic of spirit that says, if you do something good that is good to the patient, to the one he was nursing, then it must be good, and good is good, so it can't be evil for himself. Good cannot be good for the patient and evil for the one who was nursing. Good remains good. Man is amenable to spirit only, and that spirit is good and is good always. So it must do not only the patient good, but also the one who has served and nursed the patient. He too must be blessed. That's always the great point that mortal mind always puts a penalty on doing something good. It's quite interesting. And therefore also one can see that every advancing step in civilization is always ushered in through blood. Always ushered in through blood. Every great idea, you can go right back through the history. Whenever a new idea came in, like the Reformation, you had just a religious war. When the idea of freedom came in, that man is free, you had the French Revolution and you had blood. It seems as if every new idea of good would be ushered in through struggle, through evil. And this is a mortal belief. It's a mortal belief of duality, that good can bring forth anything else but good. Then Mrs. Eddy goes to a third point where Christian Science comes in and defends the case, namely soul, where Christian Science wants to bring out that man is free from sin and penalty. She says here, only sin can be penalized. Man can never be penalized, because man, the true man, can never sin, so he can never be penalized. It's only sin, and sin is a mortal belief, it's not man, penalizes itself. And therefore, penalty is only due for sin. So that mortal man can only suffer for sin, mortal man. But good deeds are immortal, bringing joy and life. There is no penalty for doing good deeds. So the patient, now you get the tone of soul again, the patient must be restored to liberty, to the freedom of soul, restored resurrection soul. You lift him right out of all those beliefs and see that the true man, not mortal man, but the true man has never sinned, therefore he must be free from penalty, and we restore him to his primeval, sinless status of being, to his freedom of freedom from all penalty. So we set him free. That's what soul does. Soul says, I set man free. Let's see that we do that too with ourselves, that we set ourselves always free. And we have enough opportunity on occasion to do that. Only too often we consider ourselves as a sinner, consider ourselves as doing something wrong, as not being able to come up to the standard of truth, that we only too often see that we have shortcomings, that the spiritual qualities are not expressed enough in ourselves. Only too often we accuse ourselves, and we are the greatest accuser to ourselves. People may criticize us a little bit, but that is not in that measure as we criticize ourselves. We run ourselves down in all sincerity, and we rob ourselves of our true stature of manhood. We accuse ourselves only too often. Therefore, we have to sit back from time to time and say, now, who am I? Soul, who am I? What am I? Don't forget what you are. I always remember my mother. She didn't teach me very much, but she always used to say, after having talked on the telephone about how things are and what things are and how the weather is and so on, and at the end she would always say, Max, don't forget who you are. Bye-bye. See, that wonderful sense that fundamentally we always have to go right back and say, who am I? We naturally live all through the day with all kinds of human things and babble along and so on, while we have to do that. But fundamentally, underneath should always be that hum, somehow a spiritual hum that always says, don't forget who you are. Set yourself free to be a mortal, to be a person, to be living in a body. Set yourself free that you live in this century. Set yourself free that you live in a country. You are not living in time nor in space, and therefore not in a body, not as a person, not in a setup, not in a group setup. You are always living in the freedom of soul. And you only are only that what soul testifies about you. So we set ourselves free. Or we come to the next point of principle, where Christian Science still pleads the case, where Christian Science still defends the whole case now from the point of view of principle, and says, or my epitome is, man, in obedience to principle, cannot be penalized. Well, man is not trying to be obedient to principle. Man lives in obedience to principle. Man cannot help but live in obedience to principle, because man is principle's own idea, and therefore principle's own idea is always at the point of complete coordination. No, that's not the right term. Complete accord with the principle. He always harmonizes with principle. So he's always in obedience to principle, and that can never be penalized. Christian Science says here about that whole case, well, that that patient has been doing good deeds. And this means acting within the limits of divine law. Therefore, he has been in obedience to divine law. And this means acting in obedience thereto. As such acts, she says, bear their own justification. So divine laws compel men to good deeds. Obedience to the law of love cannot be construed as disobedience to the law of life. It's quite an interesting sentence here that she says, you see that she says, obedience to the law of love. See, that patient, he was watching at the bedside, doing good to his friend. Therefore, he was in obedience to the law of love. But the argument was that you can be in obedience to love and yet be penalized with death, meaning that the law of love is not synonymous with the law of life. That's the argument. And therefore, here Mrs. Eddy touches something very fundamental, namely to show that if we are in accord with one synonymous term, we are always in accord with all the seven synonymous terms, because we have seen, especially in the syllabus class 2, that we could see that the synonymy principle works that way, that we can never have a synonymous term like the law of love and not at the same time also the law of mind, the law of spirit, the law of soul, the law of principles, the law of life, and the law of truth. That here she says, she reasons really on that synonymy principle and says, obedience to the law of love also means that we are in obedience to the law of life and therefore can never be punished with death for doing the laws of love. And this is perhaps a nice indication how we, in general, really should be conscious of reality, so that we are not always restricting ourselves just to one synonymous term and consider, say, the law of love as the law of love and say, yes, that's beautiful, the law of love, forgetting that this includes within itself already that law of love has already the power of the law of mind, the intelligence of the law of mind, that has within itself already the law of spirit, namely the infinite ordering of spirit, the infinite law of spirit that always says, I unfold, I evolve, I never am frustrated, I always bring forth. So that law of love is always reflecting the law of soul, which says that law of love is superior to everything and therefore can never be subject to anything that is unlike love. Or that it is, as here, reflecting the law of life and says, going along the law of love, you go along the law of life. Therefore, it will always give you more life and the newness of life and the freshness of life and the multiplication of life and the spontaneity of life. That is all the law of life. That everything happens within the multiplication of life, the spontaneity of life, the exaltation of life, so that we feel that we cannot go along one law of love and then reap the very opposite and counterfeit of a law of life. That does not work that way. So actually, you see, if we have a real good sense of the seven synonymous terms, and then afterwards, like in syllabus 2, we see how these seven synonymous terms and their ideas blend and blend infinitely, but according to definite rules, we are actually put into a position to deal with every situation and to give a treatment that is independent on the text and can give a very, very intelligent treatment. not a treatment that just recapitulates some kind of a statement which we have in mind and remember, but that we really can go out from one statement, like the law of love, and from there deduce from that includes many other laws. That law of love includes, like here, the law of life, and therefore can only bring us newness of life, the freshness of life, the rejuvenation of life, the infinite exaltation of life, the nowness of life, the spontaneity of life, and the multiplication of life, so that there is no sense that this law of love can have an opposite effect on another synonymous term. It's just no more possible. Gosh, you know, if only Christian Scientists would be willing to simplify their knowledge of Christian Science, and to simplify it, and to simplify, and would get rid of their thousands of facts that they have accumulated in their brain about Christian Science, just drop everything, just throw it overboard and out of the window into a garbage can, and just go back to that simplicity where Mrs. Eddy says, what is God? There is no bigger question than what is God. Is there a bigger question than what is God? There isn't. So her answer is just one line, and given the seventh synonymous term, that should be enough. That would really be faithful over a few things and make us really ruler of many things. Because if we are faithful to those few things and see them in their proper light and know how they blend with each other, how the synonymy principle works, that not one can stand alone, that everyone blends with the other one, we would fill the whole earth with our consciousness of infinitely diversified and rarefied blendings of the seven and their ideas.